This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Health research has received more attention in the last year, with researchers working on vaccines for the COVID-19 virus, among other things. And today we're talking about health research in Indiana. With us now to talk about it is Dr. Sharon Moe, co-director of the Indiana Clinical and Translational Sciences Institute. Welcome, Dr. Moe. Has there been more of a focus on health research during this pandemic?
Absolutely. I think the news is full of the latest vaccine trials or the latest discovery or the latest study that failed. Vaccine history, vaccine, everything has been in the press. So we have clearly, for once, or for the first time, I think there's a lot of information about how things get approved, how drugs and new things get approved through the FDA, as well as how they get studied in patients.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I think even for myself, I learned a lot on the stages that things go through. I'd always thought it was just like, okay, it gets approved and that's that. But there are so many steps behind the scenes.
Very much so. Very much so. And I think that's what the CTSI is really all about, is to help that provide that foundation and that infrastructure in the state of Indiana for that translation. That's what we're called, the clinical translational, because translation means taking it from an idea in a lab, for example, to the first in human studies, such as a COVID vaccine trial, but also taking things that we know work in clinical trials and translating them to the population as a whole. So perhaps deciding that everyone needs to have vaccines, for example, in your previous segment, or that they need to take medications. Those kinds of health decisions that are made are part of both extremes of translation from the Clinical Translational Science Institute.
Well, when it comes to the focus of health research this past year and a half or so with the pandemic that we're under, have you seen a dramatic shift in how health research is being conducted, or is it just that the public's more aware?
I think it's mostly the public is more aware. The rules and regulations around doing health research have been in place for many, many years, and they are still strictly followed. We did have to kind of adjust and change as the pandemic hit us. When we were trying to recruit patients, we couldn't necessarily do it in person. So our infrastructure of the CTSI, the foundation, quickly reorganize certain things to have more rapid approval committees for COVID-related research, changes to the way that we consent patients not having to do it in person, doing it by video or by phone. So we adapted, I would say, more than changed.
Would you say, when you're saying your some of the adjustments and changes to be able to have more rapid approval in different things and the way things are done, does that show that in the past maybe things were taking too long and maybe there were better ways to do things?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of regulations around how we do informed consent. That's the process by which we tell someone that they're going to be in a research study and we explain the risks and benefits. When you are in a crisis situation and the potential benefit is going to be more rapidly taken up, then I think it's important that you do have those adaptations. However, it's also very important that we maintain the processes that ensure the safety and well-being of everyone who participates in research. And we did so. What will change, I think, is our ability to be a little more flexible in how we do informed consent, how we actually talk to patients about research studies. We have already developed a lot of platforms, partly spurred on by the pandemic, but partly in process before, to actually talk to people more virtually. As you know, things sometimes are hard to change. It's an important process, and it's really what gives people the satisfaction that the research that is being done in an excellent manner. And I mean, one of the things, you know, a lot of the vaccine hesitancy is because of the uncertainties around the COVID vaccine. So how come it got developed so fast? How did this happen? And you know, rest assured that the processes and the science was already there. They just kind of shifted and turned towards COVID rather than other viruses. And so that's how come it was led to a more rapid development process than one might expect. But still safe. It's still following those rules. And everyone should know that.
And wouldn't technology be part of that too? I'm just thinking, you know, there's been a lot of conversations about the flu pandemic in 1918 and how it took so long to finally get a vaccine for that. But we're in a different time where we have so many other tools at our fingertips that I would presume that you can come up with things quicker.
Absolutely. And there were already tools developed, such as this mRNA technology and other vaccine technologies to fight Ebola, to fight the previous SARS infections. And so turning that technology and optimizing it, we now know we can have that ready-made technology and then just alter or tweak the type of target for these certain vaccines. And that's why our CTSI is so great in Indiana, is because we don't just have IU, we actually have Purdue and Notre Dame as our partners. And so we're working as a whole across the entire state by looking at how drug development can happen quicker and by looking at new devices to enable research, whether it's how you actually test for a patient's, how they're doing in a certain study, or whether it's actually a delivery of something like a vaccine. And then, you know, we have the beautiful IU Health and IU School of Medicine system set up where we have multiple locations around the state that facilitate our research. The other thing that happened, I think, during the pandemic is we still did a lot of research. In fact, we have several programs. One in particular was called the P2P program, where researchers from IU Bloomington went around the state and randomly sampled patients about things that were going on in their life, as well as getting DNA samples for future research. And these are the kinds of infrastructure that help future research. If you have the samples collected, the data collected, then a lot of different researchers can use that to ask many questions, some which we couldn't even anticipate right now, just like no one could have anticipated COVID 2 years ago. So that infrastructure is just key for investigators to be successful for the research they're doing now and for thinking about what kind of research needs to happen in the future.
That's really amazing to be able to build that up and have that ready on hand. I'm wondering, you mentioned earlier about educating folks about informed consent. How does that come into play when, for example, you're sampling patients and holding on to data for the future?
So the informed consent process is actually determined by a federal law, and the content of this piece of paper or online video or telephone message is all approved by a external body to the research. We call that the Institutional Review Board. And on that committee are community representatives who have nothing to do with the research and researchers who are not directly involved in that particular research project. So they approve it to make sure a couple things. One is, does it adequately represent the risks and benefits of the study? And second, are the patient's identities protected as pertinent for that research? So in the case of a large study, for example, collecting DNA, we inform the patients that this DNA could be used for future research. We just can't anticipate what that is. And patients always have the right to refuse the consent and have the right to withdraw their data down the road if they so choose. So it's very heavily reviewed by a committee to make sure that it's safe from a patient's perspective, but also the patients always have, or the subjects always have, the ability to say no. And that's why it's called informed consent. And that's why I mentioned we don't really want to short that process. It's really important for the integrity of research and the safety of participants.
Well, what kind of role does Indiana play in the larger scope of health research across the country?
Well, we have a wonderful Indiana Clinical and Translational Science Institute, as you mentioned, and we actually have a huge biomedical research infrastructure in terms of the business here. People often don't think about us as it being a biosciences hub, but we actually rank around fifth in the country in terms of pharmaceutical and bioscience industries. So we work closely at the Indiana CTSI, which is more of an academic center infrastructure with BioCrossroads and many of the companies in the state of Indiana. And we have a long ways to go in Indiana. We are one of the unhealthiest states in terms of many markers of health, infant mortality, smoking, obesity, et cetera. And so we are teaming together with everyone we can in the state to try to make things better. And that's why you'll hear from my colleagues here about how one of the first steps to becoming a healthier Indiana is to convey accurate information and to engage the community as being a partner in improving health. Many of the things that impact health are actually environmental, meaning they're in the neighborhoods. They're environmental is what we call them. They're structural determinants of what happens. So violence, ability to take a walk, food insecurity. So in the CTSI, we focus not only on how a drug or a device is made in the lab, but we also are focusing on our community and how we can improve some of those barriers to successful health. And only through both of that is it going to actually improve over time.
Well, before we wrap up here, we have about 2 minutes. Is there anything that you're working on right now that's really significant out of CTSI?
So I think we have a lot of things going on. It's hard to narrow it down, but I'd like to point out a couple of the really cool things that have happened in the last few years. First of all, from a device, our CTSI has helped to fund a speech and language device that helps patients with Parkinson's to deliver more clear words. We've developed a new device for children born with facial deformities for sleep apnea, a CPAP mask that actually fits. We have been very involved in drug development of a drug to cure amyloidosis and X-linked rickets, both of them very rare but very horrifying diseases. We have also, as I mentioned before, collected DNA on a number of patients. We were instrumental in doing a very large vaccine trial for the AstraZeneca vaccine. And we also have many other activities in terms of looking at clinical trials. We have we're building now a statewide clinical trial network so that we can move those out quicker. We've done things as simple as the Monon Collaborative, where we help have a team of people who are partners in a pregnancy for a woman who may have some addiction issues to make sure that they actually have a safe pregnancy and provide that support. So a lot of things across that spectrum of translational and clinical research.
That's impressive. And it's all happening here in Indiana.
Absolutely. And you'll learn more now about how you can be a participant in clinical research.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Dr. Sharon Moe is co-director of the Indiana Clinical and Translational Sciences Institute. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about health research in Indiana, how it's conducted, and how Hoosiers can get involved in clinical trials. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about health research in Indiana, and we're joined now by Dr. Lauren Nephew, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Nephew. It's great to have you back with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You are a physician and a researcher, and so I guess one of the big questions is, how do you balance those two roles?
Well, it could be challenging, but I love wearing both hats. As a physician, I get to see patients, to meet them, to help diagnose their problems. I get to know their families. I get to know them over long periods of time and to see them improve. And then as a scientist, I get to think about problems that may be helping or hindering them from achieving the best care that they can and how we might be able to solve those problems. So even though they're two separate hats, they work hand in hand. As a physician, I want to treat the individual patient. And as a scientist, I want to try to help figure out how I can treat a broader population of patients who may have similar issues. And so they work together, being a physician and a scientist.
And you're also a KL2 scholar. Can you tell us what that means?
Sure. So, you know, when you're trying to solve problems and do research studies, it really takes finances, it takes support, it takes mentorship, it takes an infrastructure. And so being a KL2 scholar means that I submitted a proposal to the Clinical and Translational Science Institute of Indiana, and they reviewed it and they said, this sounds like a good idea. It sounds like this is something that's going to advance the health of people in our state. And it seems that she has good support and that she may actually be able to achieve these goals. And we're going to support her and help her do that. And so as a KL2 scholar, you get the support of the Clinical and Translational Science Institute, the infrastructure and all different groups and people that they have to help you to achieve kind of your research aims. You get some finances because research is expensive. You get mentorship. You get peer mentorship because as a KL2 scholar, there are also other KL2 scholars who are similarly doing research projects in other areas. So you get to learn from those scholars. So it's a great opportunity to really help advance a research project for early career investigator like myself.
That's awesome. And so what is your focus in your practice, what you do day to day? And then is that the same as the research that you do? Is it tied to what you're doing?
Yeah, they are tied. So as a physician, I see patients who have liver disease. And so people who have fatty liver disease, alcohol-associated liver disease, hepatitis C, conditions like these, I see those patients in my clinic, and I see those patients really at the end of their kind of course with disease as well when they might need transplant. So I'm a transplant hepatologist, which just means that I see patients who might need transplant. Many of my patients often ask me if I'm a surgeon. I'm not a surgeon, but I do help to figure out who needs a transplant, when they might need it, and to help get them to transplant. And similarly, as a scientist, I study barriers and access to care for vulnerable populations. So populations that may have a hard time navigating care. Often that can be in liver disease. It can be women. It can be racial and ethnic minorities. It can be the underinsured. And so I'm interested in studying how can we make accessing care, getting through the transplant process, getting treatment for liver cancer, getting treatment for hepatitis C. How can we make that easier? How can we lower the barrier so that everyone is achieving equitable care?
And what was it that led you to go down this path? I mean, it seems pretty specific, the kind of work that you're doing. Was there anything that just piqued your interest that got you involved?
I think just seeing health inequity all around. I think I study a very kind of specific disease, right? So I study mm-hmm. liver cancer and hepatitis C. But really, if you're looking at barriers to care, these things can be seen in all types of areas of care. So diabetes and hypertension. And if you're a healthcare provider and you're taking care of patients, time and time again, you say, wow, I wish that I could give this patient this, but they don't have enough insurance. I wish that I could help this patient get this treatment, but I don't think it was explained to them very well. And maybe we didn't communicate it effectively. And there's some issues with health knowledge and health literacy. So I think as a physician, even as a medical student, you quickly see that there are a number of barriers to people's care. And if you could just do something about it. And so I think I began to see those barriers to care early on and really wanted to do something about the social needs and structural determinants of health that I think make it difficult for people to access care.
And you mentioned health literacy and health knowledge. Would you say that for the most part, the public isn't really health literate, or is it just dependent upon, I guess, whether people are having access to health in general?
I think that there are kind of two separate issues, and there's difficulty with both. I think that people struggle with health-related knowledge, and part of that is because physicians aren't always great at communicating effectively in a way that people can understand. And so when a patient walks away from a visit and they don't understand why they saw me, what treatment they are supposed to be considering, I consider that, onus to be on us. And so, yes, I think there are lots of issues with health-related knowledge, but I think we are learning how to be better at physicians at communicating with patients effectively. And then access is different because there are some people who have really great health knowledge and can communicate very effectively with their physicians, but still have difficulty accessing care just because it can be difficult from an insurance standpoint. And some people have multiple providers for many different conditions, and it's hard even for a very savvy person to be able to navigate that system. So I think there are issues with health knowledge and literacy. There are issues with access. They can be separate, and they can both exist or they can exist independently. And I think as physicians, we're trying to do better at communicating effectively so that patients can understand exactly what's going on so they can make informed decisions.
Well, if you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Dr. Lauren Nephew, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Dr. Nephew, I wonder, if, for folks that might have some health literacy or seem to be, I guess, understanding what's going on, do you think that the internet creates problems like when patients come in and say, well, I read on Google, blah, blah, blah?
It can. I think I'm excited. So I won't say I'm excited. I am happy to hear when a patient is interested in figuring out what's going on with them. That makes me know that they are active in their care, they are engaged, they are involved, they really want to know, why is this happening to me? So I take that as an opportunity. I said, this is a person who really wants to learn. And then I try to redirect if there's been misinformation that's been gathered. The internet is just full of information. It's really hard to know what's accurate, what's inaccurate. So I wouldn't say that the internet has been a hindrance to the doctor-patient relationship per se, but I think it's an opportunity for me to redirect patients, to provide the right information. It lets me know that they're really engaged. They really want to know what's going on. It can require some redirection, but I'm okay with that.
Well, I'm glad to hear your viewpoint on that, because I'm one of those Googlers sometimes.
I'm like, I think a lot of people are.
Yeah, I mean, but we have to be careful, obviously, about the sources. And, you know, I try to stick to things like Mayo Clinic or whatever, versus these random medical websites. But the research that you've been working on, what is some of the stuff that you've done recently?
Well, right now I'm trying to understand barriers in care for patients with hepatocellular carcinoma, which is liver cancer. And so I'm trying to understand what social determinants and what social needs might impede people from accessing liver cancer care. Liver cancer is complex because people have not only cancer, but they have cirrhosis. So they have two very challenging diagnoses. And then on top of that, patients may also bring different social needs and social determinants to the table that can make it challenging for them to understand all of their different referrals, all of their different providers, all this complex information about radiation, chemotherapy, transplant. And so recently, we're trying to understand exactly what social needs do people have. Are they associated with poor health outcomes when people have a lot of unmet social needs? And then are there social needs that we might be able to mitigate from inside the healthcare system? Certainly, we can't put money in people's pockets, but can we help lower the barriers to care? Can we link people with social workers? Can we give them more health related information at a level that they can understand? Can we communicate more effectively? And so we're trying to understand which are the barriers or which social needs are most important and which ones can we effectively act on from inside the healthcare system.
And is this research still ongoing, or were you able to find some results?
It's still ongoing. What we have found is that health literacy is a big issue in our liver patient population, and that on many health literacy studies, about 60 to 70% of people have difficulty with health-related literacy and health-related knowledge. And so it makes it really hard to effectively navigate a complex system if your health literacy is low. And so knowing that, we know that we need to be much more committed to and providing information at multiple different places in their pathway of care, where they can learn about their disease and so that they can make effective choices. A lot of times people are labeled as non-compliant or not interested in care when they really just don't understand exactly what's been offered to them and what the risk benefits are of those treatments. And so now we're working on a kind of knowledge tool to help patients to better understand hepatocellular carcinoma and all the different treatment options that are available for them in a way that kind of meets them where they are.
Did you find at all that there were generational differences in health literacy? For example, maybe older generations not engaged as much because maybe back in the day they weren't given that much information?
That's an interesting question. I actually haven't looked at our data by age group. Liver cancer usually affects people who are over 50, but we probably do have some younger people in our cohort, and that would be interesting to look at. I think what we do know is how we give health information differs by age cohort. And so while you might be able to give a tablet to a younger group of patients, and they might be able to kind of look at that tablet and navigate some type of tablet-based educational programming, that might not be the best way to meet our 65 plus. They may prefer an in-person kind of teaching session, more traditional, with a coordinator to help them walk through it, as opposed to maybe a tablet-based intervention. So we do know we have to meet our patients at different places depending on their birth cohort and their experience with technology.
Is that one of the biggest challenges that you face doing this research, or is there something else that would also be challenging?
Well, there's a lot of challenges. I think I think it's challenging to convince people that you can mitigate or act on social needs from in the healthcare system. Traditionally, physicians have thought that social needs and social determinants should be left to policy people. And then if we can expand Medicaid, if we can do different things from a policy level, then there's nothing really a doctor can do about your social needs. So I think one barrier is just convincing folks that just like hypertension, just like obesity, you need to identify social needs as a risk factor for disease. And convincing folks that perhaps you can do something about it, that we are equipped to do something about it, and that if we are going to get rid of health disparities and make healthcare equitable, yes, we've got to come up with really exciting novel vaccines and medications, but if you can't get people to take them, we already see what happens, right?
Right.
So you've got to be able to explain things and get people to uptake things and get people to get there, and having all the great treatments doesn't help if you can't help people to receive them. So I think there's, you know, just convincing folks that it can be done, and then figuring out what cost-effective strategies can be implemented from within the healthcare system are the biggest challenges for those of us who study social determinants and social needs right now.
Well, when it comes to disparities in health equity, and I'm thinking about, for example, clinical trials that are done, do they accurately represent the population?
Well, that's been a struggle. So for decades, we've seen clinical trials not be fully representative of minorities and women. There's been efforts made to try to increase attention in that area, to try to get investigators to understand that it's important for our results to be generalizable, for them to look like there are study populations to look like the general population. I think I was very optimistic when I saw the vaccine studies, because those are some of the most representative cohorts we've seen in large clinical trials, with upwards of 10% of African-American participant enrollment, and even higher in Latinx populations. And so for me, that showed me that this can be done, that clinical trial studies can look more like the general population when there's really an impetus. I think Moderna, Pfizer, they knew that if we were going to get significant uptake of these vaccines, that they would have to have a study population that represented the U.S. population. And so they set out to do that, making enrollment sites in urban communities, having weekend and evening enrollments, collaborating with community organizations, and doing what had to be done. So I think it can be done if it's made a priority.
Right. And I think that's the key word, the priority. I think, you know, for so long, it's just the systemic inequities that have been in place that created some of this, which makes me wonder, you know, you mentioned that women and minorities are not represented really well in clinical trials. And I don't know if this is accurate, but I've heard, like, even medications that you might take, the dosages are for, like, a typical, I don't know, 30-year-old white male, and then you're a female and your dosage shouldn't be the same. Is that fair to say?
Well, it's complicated. I would say that, you know, with many medicines, your gender may not matter for the dose. It may be more your size and And so they're certainly small men, but I think that these are questions that are unanswered. I think there's probably complex interactions that happen based on gender, some based on race and different people's exposure because of their race that we're missing. And so I don't think that medicines are currently dangerous for men, for women or for minorities, because clinical trials have not had adequate enrollment. But I do think that there are nuances to medicines, how they act, what populations they may act best in, that may be missing because these populations have not been very diverse.
Well, before we wrap up, what can researchers do to improve the diversity in their studies?
It's challenging. I think it's challenging mostly because it's costly. Because really, if you're going to improve diversity in your trials, then you have to think about, okay, how many study visits do I have? Are these happening during times when people work? Can people afford to take time off work? If they can't, can I reimburse them for that? Can we have weekend hours, evening hours? For our Latinx populations, can we have translators? Have these documents been translated into Spanish? What are my exclusion criteria? Are we excluding people with comorbidity because we want to have a very safe and perfect trial? But does that make us therefore exclude many minority populations that may have diabetes and chronic kidney disease? Have I explained the trial adequately to my minority patients, or am I afraid that they're going to say no, so I don't really push in a way that I might for other folks? So I think there's things that could be done.
All right, Dr. Lauren Nephew, we'll be back after a break. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soe. Back now to our discussion on health research and efforts to encourage Hoosiers across the state to get involved in clinical studies. We're joined now by Dr. Silk Soto, faculty at the IU School of Medicine and researcher, as well as the co-director of the Racial Justice Task Force of the Indiana Clinical and Translational Sciences Institute. She's also the director of All In for Health, which is not affiliated with her show, but, you know, it's a great name. Welcome to the program, Dr. Soto.
Thank you, Miriam.
Well, before the break, we spoke to Dr. Lauren Nephews about diversity in clinical trials. What kind of work do you do on the Racial Justice Task Force, and is it tied into that at all?
Oh, absolutely. In the Racial Equity Task Force through the Indiana Clinical and Translational Science Institute, we're really looking not only at the research that is sponsored by the Institute, but also in everything that we do. Does it really point to equity in our practices, in the structure that we have, and how it also impacts communities that we serve?
And what role does racial justice have in health research? What is the main objective?
Oh, absolutely. So we definitely think about racial justice in the context of health equity. Personally, I ascribe to the notion that education access and health equity is the road to actual equality in this country. So through racial justice, we're really guaranteeing that we are addressing all issues, structural and those that are not structural, in advancing health equity for the populations that we serve in the state of Indiana.
And when it comes to the state of Indiana and sort of health equity and the things that you're trying to do, are things changing for the better, or are things still sort of stuck in some of these systemic problems?
Well, when you look at the data in terms of Indiana's one of, I believe, 41st as one of the least healthy states, you would think that we still have a problem, right? In the sense that we need to really promote healthy activity, healthy living, healthy research in the state in order to really impact those metrics as well as the health of all Hoosiers.
And before we talk more about that, I want to mention All In for Health, the program you're the director of. What is this program aiming to do?
Sure. So the All In for Health is one of the signature programs by the Indiana CTSI, and it has been dedicated to improving the lives of Hoosiers by encouraging health literacy and promoting participation in health research, especially when it comes to clinical studies. Since 2017 or so, really, this has been the focus, trying to explain what health research is, what it does, key terms, information, et cetera. But also, we provide health resources and opportunities to participate in health research, and we want to continue to be one of those trustworthy sources of information and research. And in many ways, share the voices and health interests of the communities that we are part of, right? You don't need to go to just the Mayo Clinic site, as you mentioned earlier. You can go to the All In for Health and have trustworthy information from the Indiana CTSI.
Well, that's good to know. I'm definitely going to be on your website a lot, so hopefully it doesn't crash. So I know we spoke with Dr. Nephew about health literacy, and what does health literacy mean to you, and how is All In for Health helping to increase that, perhaps?
That's a great question. So to me and to many others, health literacy is truly the degree in which our patients have the capacity and the ability to process the information that our providers offer, as well as understanding this basic health information that is needed in order to make appropriate or really important health decisions and really have an impact on health outcomes. So through All In, we want to be, again, the place where individuals can actually access health information in a way that is accessible, that is understandable, that it's at their reading level, that we are not being too fancy with the words that we're using in really explaining health issues, and especially encouraging participation in research.
Yeah, I think definitely some of the terminology can get complicated, and unless you're in the field, it just goes over your head. Do you have any examples of things that you were able to, I guess, communicate better with folks that when they come to your website?
Oh, that is a really good point. So I want to at least highlight what we did in the Indiana CTSI through Dr. Cindy Brown as the PI of the AstraZeneca vaccine trial. We had an incredible number of participants that volunteered to be part of that COVID trial. And through that, we were able to not only explain COVID in a way that it's was understood, but also explain the whole clinical trial process and participation in ways that really encouraged over 500 Hoosiers to actually participate in this research.
Wow, that's impressive. And you know, speaking of clinical trials, I think they can be complicated to understand. I'm just thinking from my own perspective, when I hear about this, it just seems so tedious. And how would you encourage folks to get involved in clinical trials?
Well, I will definitely encourage them to visit the All In for Health website. And in there, they will be able to sign up for a newsletter, as well as a complete volunteer profile if they're interested in participating in research. I have to say that we host and promote research, everything from simple, you know, research surveys or questionnaires to really disease-specific types of clinical trials. So all the information can be found in the All In for Health website.
If you're listening and have a question or comment, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Dr. Silk Soto, faculty at the IU School of Medicine and researcher, as well as the co-director of the Racial Justice Task Force of the Indiana Clinical and Translational Sciences Institute. She's also the director of All In for Health. Again, no relation to the show, but a great name. Dr. Soto, when we look at Indiana, we recently did a segment on the annual American Fitness Index, and it showed that Indiana ranks fairly low. How do you see Indiana compared to other states when it comes to health?
Well, I think that actually says it all, right? That there is a lot of work that we need to do in order to increase the health of Hoosiers, that it is not just truly about activity. Since my framework is looking at health research, I think that through health research and participation in programs like the All In for Health and generally in clinical trials, we can then promote healthy living for residents. And if we do that, then we will have a better understanding about our community's concerns and barriers to good health. So there's a lot more than we can do in the state. And obviously, the Indiana CTSI is a place that is truly moving that forward, along with our academic partners such as Purdue and Notre Dame and IU.
And for people who want to get involved and aren't sure how to help, maybe they don't want to do a clinical trial. Is there anything else that they can participate in?
Well, there are other forms of research and when it comes to health promotion. So it's not necessarily just clinical trials. We have plenty of educational research and other forms of research that are happening at academic institutions, again, such as our partners. So contributing to science, I do think that it's a great way to do so by participating in all sorts of different kinds of research. But again, in the in hopes to really advance health and promoting health in the state of Indiana, we really want to encourage participants that are willing at least to have a conversation about what a clinical trial is and therefore, you know, learn more in hopes that they will engage in the future.
You mentioned earlier that you had about 500 people participate in the COVID vaccine trial. Was that surprising to get that many people? Like, are you seeing that there's a shift in more people getting involved?
Well, I don't know that it was surprising. If anything, it's truly encouraging. Right now, the All In for Health registry has about 30,000 Indiana residents who have opted to receive information through the All In for Health newsletter and updates. So that is 30,000 Indiana residents. Right now we have about 13,000 who have completed that deeper volunteer profile to actually consent to participate in our health research studies. So again, I think that there is willingness and quite excitement, I think, by Hoosiers to actually participate in clinical research.
Are there any examples of research that's been done in Indiana that led to health improvements for Hoosiers?
Oh, that I can't speak too much of, but I am sure that that is indeed the case, especially when you look at the track record of the Indiana CTSI and the researchers, and obviously researchers like Dr. Laren Nephew, who have had an impact already in terms of health outcomes in the state of Indiana.
Well, when it comes to sort of the health research that's done at your institute, how do you decide what projects, I guess, get the green light to go forward? Because I'm sure there's a lot of different ideas hypotheses. I'm going to try to sound like a scientist that are put forward. So how do you choose which ones actually make it to the next level?
That is a great question. When it comes to All In for Health, our job is to promote the health research that is happening through the Indiana CTSI and again, through our partners with Purdue Notre Dame at IU. In that sense, we're really promoting all sorts of research that may include interventions, health services research, community projects. So we really promote a variety of studies that are being done through all of our academic partners and the Indiana CTSI. Obviously, things like oncology-related research might be one of our top types of research that are happening, but we truly have a diverse variety of studies happening.
And is it costly to do health research? Is that part of the issue with getting different things out there?
I will say it's costly because we always need, more funding to do the research that we want to do. But in reality, it definitely varies. The kind of research that is supported by Indiana CTSI, again, can be really costly when you're thinking about really extensive clinical trials or drug development or things of that matter. But we also have other types of health research that are not necessarily that costly. For example, I'm working right now on a research study that is looking at enrollment in clinical trials from the lessons learned from the AstraZeneca study. And although I would like to say it's really costly, it's really what it takes is time to interview individuals and really learn about their motivation for participating in clinical research and the barriers to enrollment. So that may actually involve a little bit of cost, but it might not be as elevated cost as some other studies. So I think that you will find a variety of clinical research and projects around health research that definitely vary in costs.
And how did you get into this field? I'm curious, like, how you went down this path to research and the racial justice and all of that.
So I consider myself an equity scholar, and I really have spent my professional career in higher education and in academic medicine. So again, my research centers a little bit more on social, educational, and health equity research as ways that I think are truly about access and equality at the end of the day. I've been in academic medicine for over 20 years and really believe in the work that is done here in terms of contributing to that goal.
And have you seen changes over your career of things moving in a positive direction?
Yes, I have seen changes in terms of the numbers of minoritized groups that we have participating in higher education and academic medicine, and those individuals that are becoming physicians themselves and contributing to the field, and the type of research that we currently do that is really more focused on structural and social determinants of health. In the way that I teach medical students, and we really spend a chunk of our time really talking about what is culturally competent, what is becoming culturally humble when it comes to our interactions with patients. So I think all of that really brings an equity lens to our education and therefore to our practices as physicians and providers in the health system.
It's interesting you're mentioning the cultural competency, because I feel like now more fields are starting to become aware of the importance of that. And I wonder in medicine, why, maybe you wouldn't have the answer to this, but like why it's taken so long to get to this point.
That is a great question, and one that I wish we had a different segment to talk about.
Yeah.
Dr. Nephew that actually mentioned the complexities of actually explaining, for example, a diagnosis and really understanding what level the patient is at, what level the family is at, and understanding a particular disease, or really understanding all the terms that are thrown at them. So it's really, really important to have culturally competent. And for me, I do practice a little bit more about cultural humility in how we interact with individuals and how we think about communicating not only complex medical terms, but how we actually engage with individuals as patients in a holistic way that is not just about a transaction, but is truly about getting to know them and getting to understand the structural and social circumstances that have determined where they are at today.
Mm-hmm. And I think that definitely changes sort of the dynamic hearing this you said cultural humbleness. I can't remember what you just said.
I said cultural humility.
Humility. Yeah. That's a new term for me to hear. And I think it's interesting because my own interaction or interactions I've heard of other folks with people in the medical profession is, oh, you know, their ego and they know everything. And then you feel so shy to say anything because they're so much smarter than you.
Well, if anybody that is listening to this, they might be questioning the fact that I only mentioned cultural humility twice.
Yeah.
Now three times.
Well, I really, really appreciate your insight. And before we go, we have about 30 seconds. Is there anything you're hopeful or working on for the future that you think we should know about?
Oh, I want to highlight right now the Indiana State Fair. So we're currently conducting a social media contest, and we really encourage everybody to go and visit our Twitter and Facebook and Instagram page in Be All In. And we are, I think, doing keeping, you know, health in the top of mind and really encouraging individuals to be healthy at the state of at the Indiana State Fair. And you can win one of three 25 Amazon gift cards if you actually post and show how you're staying healthy at the fair.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Silk Soto, co-director of the Racial Justice Task Force of the Indiana CTSI, director of All In for Health, researcher and faculty member at the IU School of Medicine. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. This is All In.